That empire was destroyed when the game had to be reset, and the Keeper hadn't given any instructions to either recreate it or invest any more personal time in the game since then.
Sure, I think I know how I can get it working.
Dana nodded her head, starting to piece together a spell in her mind. She had been the one to create the fourth-tier sentient spell known as Gerard, so setting up a difficulty filter like this wasn't that much of a problem.
Yes, I knew I could count on you.
Aurevy grinned broadly, but Dana held up a hand. First, I'll need a complete list of every monster or trap that your dungeon is set to be able to generate, including their abilities, estimated level, and generated rewards. After that, I can start working on the spell that will tie all of that into a single system. Aurevy nodded her head quickly, clearly pleased by the results of the conversation. However, a moment later her expression froze, causing Dana to blink. Is everything all right?
The March world is collapsing, she said, in a serious tone.
Dana's eyes shot open wide at that.
Have they finished evacuations?
Only about half,
Aurevy said, with a shake of her head.
It's collapsing inwards, the edge of the observable universe disintegrating, with the collapse moving at roughly 40 million times the speed of light. Worse, it's getting faster the more it goes. 50 million, 60 million. They only have less than an hour.
Dana knit her brows together. She knew that this estimate was taking into account the fallen gods trying to stabilize the barrier.
Can they get out in time?
Aurevy didn't have an answer to that. At the very least, it was clear that they wouldn't all make it.
Hi, Mother! An urgent report from long-range sensors!
A Mi-Tong soldier ran into the High Mother's office, a look of shock on his face. However, the High Mother simply nodded her head.
I'm aware. It's time,
she said, closing her eyes. She had long since moved her residence aboard one of the largest ships in the entire Mi-Tong fleet, ready to abandon this universe at a moment's notice. Walking over to the window out of her office, nothing looked different in the dark sky. Of course, it wouldn't. The collapse was happening so fast that it was faster than the light still traveling towards them. Without the support of sensors placed at an extreme distance to prepare for this eventuality, they would have simply been erased without ever knowing.
Send a report to all vessels and relay my command to the March King.
We will attempt to perform a synchronized void jump to the coordinates given by the Another World Research Group. All ships must leave at exactly the same time. An exodus of this scale could shatter the world entirely, and anything that is left behind for even a fraction of a second longer could be erased from existence. This fact wasn't something that they had told the other commanders, and only she and the March King knew about. If the ship captains knew that such a thing would happen, if they were delayed, they may have already left, leading to the downfall of everyone else. Now she needed to coordinate to perform this synchronized jump.
Understood, High Mother, the soldier reported, saluting the High Mother as he relayed the message.
Link all Mi-Tong ship systems directly to the Iron Throne. Only the March King has a chance of performing a jump of this scale.
Although she didn't want to admit it, the March King was a far better choice than herself for this. His domain of communication meant that he had a better chance of instantly communicating with the systems of every ship at once, and processing all of that information.
Understood. The soldier nodded, this time with a more solemn expression.
The lights in the ship flickered as the remote controls were transferred to the authority of the March King. At this point, the High Mother could only close her eyes and hope for the best.
Compensating timing for distance delay and individual ship capabilities. Initiating warp in 10. The March King's staticky voice spoke out through the ship's speakers, slowly counting down.
As soon as he hit zero, the High Mother felt the space twisting around her, the familiar sensation of the ship jumping through the void. She let out a sigh of relief, glad that the jump was successful. The March King didn't make an announcement, but that was in line with his style.
Analyze the losses. How many made it? She asked, preparing for the worst.
The soldier closed his eyes, sending out several pings to various ships in the fleet.
"Roughly 97% of all Mi-Tung ships are accounted for, High Mother," he announced in a joyous tone, before his silver face seemed to lose its luster.
"And the march?" she asked, feeling as if she shouldn't have asked that.
90%. We have lost contact with 90% of the march ships, including the Iron Throne." The High Mother staggered when she heard that, eyes going wide in shock. There was no way that the March King would have sacrificed his own people to stay behind.
Did the karma of leaving people to die fall on his shoulders and cause a chain reaction even before the jump? Or were our ships just slightly more advanced than his calculations, causing his timing to be off? The High Mother's lip trembled at such a massive loss of life, including someone that she had regarded as an ally and friend for over 100 years.
Send out emergency aid to those that remain, she said, once she got her voice working again. Whether Mi-Tung or March, offer shelter to any who need it. We need to get the fleets together to prepare our next move.
Chapter 112.
Although the High Mother was mourning the loss of the March and their king, she was unable to stay still for long. After all, a significant number of their empire's worlds were still being stored within the new devices that they had created for this exodus. Before she could deal with her personal feelings, she had to first make sure that her people were taken care of. With a mental command, she sent an order to the bridge to find a suitable location to begin redeploying the stored solar systems. Chelsea had originally explained this new universe was naught but scattered cosmic dust. There were no stars, galaxies, or even any rocks to be found floating in space. This made it easier to find suitable locations, merely needing to keep in mind the relative positions of each solar system. Having lost half of their empire to the lack of time, and half of what remained to the evacuation itself, the golems were ready to start recovery. Or, at least the Mi-Tung would. As for the March, it was hard to say if they would be able to fully recover from this loss. I had to admit, when I heard what happened with the golem races, I was surprised. I assumed that they still had more time, that they would be able to save more of their people. However, when it occurred, not only had they not saved everyone, but almost all of the March ships had been destroyed.
"Are you planning to add the March King to the heroic spirits?" I asked Terra, mentally. What he did could very well be considered a sacrifice. Although not intentionally, he died for the sake of his people. Yet Terra's response was both surprising and firm.
"No, I won't," she responded, before her tone softened. "Sorry, but it's just a bad idea all around. Bad timing had a part to play in it, but there was also a karmic backlash that helped to cause his death. Keep in mind that their early departure would knowingly cause the deaths of half of their universe's surviving races." I blinked, shaking my head in refusal.
"They would have only lived for a few minutes more. Is the karmic backlash really that strong?" Terra gave a bitter chuckle in response. "If that was all, no murderer would ever suffer from negative karma. Everyone dies eventually, unless it is a case where the person is in such pain that death comes as a relief. All unnatural deaths are treated as a murder, whether they had 5 minutes to live or 500 years. The weight of karma doesn't change. Now, because this karmic backlash caused the death of the majority of the March, including their king, the Mi-Tung are currently spared from any additional backlash. The karmic debt is considered paid, and things have largely returned to balance. However, if I were to bring the king back, the one that pulled the trigger on that exodus, the karma would return with him. It would taint not only him, but also the survivors that fled to the new world. For that reason, I won't be considering him as a candidate for the heroic spirits." Unfortunately, I had to nod my head in acceptance. If there was such a karmic burden attached to the March King, then bringing him back would be like repeating the incident with James all over. Leaving aside whether or not he would be able to learn the karmic energy that James used to dispel his own negative karma,
We can't simply make disposable worlds every time someone needs to get rid of their debt. Is their new home at least stable enough that they can connect to the other universes again? More and more people were beginning to draw attention to the absence of the Mitong and March as time went on, and this would only worsen if they were still unable to connect after the world collapsed. Thankfully, it's fine for that. The world is still substantially more fragile than one created by the system, but it should last more than long enough for Chelsea's technology to finish developing. I was relieved to hear that, as it meant that the Mitong wouldn't turn into universal nomads, trapped in colony ships traveling through the void. That would be a cool mental image, though.
Don't even think about it.
Udana slumped in her chair, not sure what to make of what had happened. No matter what she did, she couldn't find the silver lining. This event did not simply end with the destruction of the Mitong's universe or the almost complete annihilation of the March Golems. There were still other effects that were yet to be resolved. One such effect, one that could be felt all over Deccan, was how Dimensium had been changed. It might sound nice for the energy it released to become more powerful, but the truth was anything but. Dimensium was used in a lot of delicate machinery, which required fine-tuning various energy signatures. Now that the balance had suddenly been broken, all of these devices were failing. Udana had no idea if the material would return to normal over time, or if they would simply have to adapt to the new situation. For this reason, she couldn't give people an answer on what to do with the modified Dimensium. For now, all that she could do was advise that people all over Deccan stopped using any delicate machinery that incorporated this material. Aside from that, she wasn't immediately sure where Asnod had gotten off to.
"Is this truly necessary?" Asnod asked with a resigned sigh as Lifra pulled him along towards the gate of Fior. "I've heard of your bomb bubble incident, but I don't think that I am really fit to assist with that, am I?"
"At least you accepted the name," Lifra said with a hearty laugh. "But no, bomb bubbles are so last week. I've found the next floor now, and this one, I think, you're super, super good for."
Asnod's brow twitched at this, trying to remember how he had gotten here. One minute he had been looking through some new recipes that he wanted to try out. The next, Lifra had appeared through a portal, grabbed his arm, and quite literally pulled him into Fior.
"How did you even know where to open that portal?"
"You're always in the kitchen," Lifra pointed out, a broad grin on her face. "Anyways, get this. You'll love the 66th floor."
Asnod simply resigned himself to going along with Lifra's whims for the moment. Had he been aware of the developments with the golem races, he likely would have rushed back to the palace to be with Udana, but he had yet to be informed of that matter.
"Very well, let's get this taken care of."
Asnod nodded his head as he followed behind Lifra, trying to imagine just what a floor of Fior had to be like for Lifra to seek him out, of all people. Lifra pulled Asnod through the gate, and his eyes suddenly went wide. There was an unfamiliar energy in the air, but it wasn't a harmful one, like the pink mist. As far as he could tell, the energy had no adverse effects on the body. What it did do was highly stimulate the sense of taste of those caught within it, merging sweet and savory tastes to fill the mouth with every breath.
"What is—"
Asnod couldn't quite find the words to express his curiosity.
"I know, right?"
Lifra smiled wide, taking a big breath.
"It's like it captures your favorite taste all the time. Oh, and it gets better."
"What do you mean, better?" Asnod asked, watching as Lifra plucked a large flower next to her feet, bringing it up to her mouth. When she inhaled, the flower seemed to dissolve into a green energy, flowing into her mouth.
"Everything on this layer is made of that energy and is completely edible. Not only does it taste really good, but it also replenishes your energy reserves like a high-class meal.
That flour filled me up better than a three-course dinner, and tasted like steak.
Asnod blinked at that, trying to decipher the meaning of what she said. According to Lifra's words, the energy here was highly nutritious. However, as an energy life form herself, she wasn't talking simply the vitamins and proteins needed for daily living, but rather how the energy itself replenished her ki, mana, and spirit. Curious, Asnod plucked a flower himself, bringing it to his mouth. As soon as his mouth opened, the flower dissolved, entering his body. He could sense how the energy that made the flower resonated with his own energy cores. Rather than directly replenishing them, this energy soothed the cores to promote the generation of more energy. The strangest part of this, aside from the taste of cheese and caramel in his mouth, was that the energy he sensed within the flower was less than the energy that the flower helped him to recover. This was something typically unheard of when it came to any form of food, as it was simply the law of conservation. If something could produce more energy than it was given, you would have a perpetual motion machine. Thus far, people have only achieved such feats by relying on divinity, the void, or high-level magic.
"Were you able to find out the cause of this?" he asked in a hesitant tone. Part of his mind was ecstatic about this discovery, already thinking of how to combine this with the energy kernels from the Hajit city to form the ultimate food. However, there was another part of him that thought that this might just be a sweet poison. What if there were hidden side effects, such as addiction or long-term consequences that hadn't been discovered yet?
Well, I was kind of curious, so I asked the one person that I thought would know, Auravi. A few hours ago, I had her do a scan of this floor to see what was up with all the amazing tastes and high-quality food energy, and she actually found something.
Asnod watched Lifra, gesturing for her to continue.
There is a primordial relic on this floor, specifically the relic containing the domain of food. The energy from that relic has spread to cover the entire layer of Fjor, making it so that almost anything can be eaten.
I see. If this was a consequence of a divine ability, Asnod could somewhat understand it, especially if the ability had been active since the dawn of the world itself.
What do you mean by almost anything?
Huh? Oh, that's an easy one. She pointed behind her at the gate that they came from. The gates still disrupt energy like this within a meter. That dirt next to the gate is just plain dirt, not some dirt-like superfood. Found that one out the hard way.
Is it just your instinct to eat everything you can? Asnod asked hesitantly.
Lifra turning to raise an amused eyebrow at him.
Is that slimest, my good sir? I'll have you know I'm offended. Or would be, if it weren't mostly true. Anyways, I thought you'd like to come and see this, and maybe you could figure out how to make this energy yourself.
You aren't able to make it?
He asked, curiously, knowing that Lifra had mastered world sight. However, Lifra simply shook her head.
I took a good look at the energy structure, and it's so complicated. I can't even tell how you'd make most of it, so I don't know where to begin. I'd have to bring in James or Chelsea for that. Maybe Dana, on a good day.
Asnod hesitated for a moment before nodding.
I'll see what I can do, then.
Chapter 113. A golden pillar rose into the sky, a lichen figure sitting in the center of it with his legs crossed. This was a rather common sight in the modern world, so much so that the venue was often rented for those seeking to make breakthroughs in their divine ascension. For this reason, it was known as the God-Chasing Platform, which consisted of a large round cushion atop a high pedestal. What made this location so special was the enchantments done on the pedestal itself. These enchantments isolated the energy of the outside world, preventing anything that could cause a disturbance at a critical moment. They had first become popular in Lorik under the name Immortal Ascension's Seat, but their names were changed when used by those aspiring to become gods rather than immortals. Once the pillar faded away, the lichen slowly rose to his feet,
taking a deep breath. He had short brown hair and golden eyes, the eyes a result of his recent ascension. It was common for new gods to not fully control their divinity, leading to golden eyes for a period of time. Nearby, another Lycan walked over, this one a female, looking at the first expectantly.
"Did it go well?" she asked,
to which he nodded his head. The male Lycan held out a hand, a golden parchment forming from his divinity. This was a manifestation of his domain.
"Exploration, just like I wanted," he said with a grin,
the woman throwing herself at him and wrapping her arms around his neck.
"I knew that you could get it, Clover," the woman, Lydia, said happily.
The two of them had gotten their divinities forged at the same time, but Lydia had managed to complete the process weeks before Clover. This was due mostly to the choices that they picked in their domains, with Clover's requiring significantly more training before he was satisfied with his chances. Clover gave a small grin, pleased with himself as well. The two of them left the platform, which locked itself down to begin dispersing the divine energy that he released during his ascension. This was to prepare the platform for its next user.
"Does this mean you're ready to head back to space?" Lydia asked in excitement,
Clover giving a small nod. "Now that we can safely travel outside of the Hyperlane network, and the two of us have ascended, there isn't anything holding us back. It might do good to take a job to make a name for ourselves. I can't sense a connection to him anymore, so I am not expecting any surplus of energy to come on its own."
Lydia pursed her lips at that, but nodded her head. She was glad that Clover was no longer connected to the Keeper, as that meant he was safer than he had ever been. Originally, they had three ideas for what might have happened if Clover were ascended to become a god. The first risk was that the strengthening divinity of his soul would cause him to be automatically reabsorbed into the Keeper again, essentially killing him. This option alone would have made ascending an unappealing prospect. The second option was that he would be locked into the same domains as the Keeper, like how when a mortal incarnation of the Greater Pantheon revealed their divinity. Finally, the last option was that he was able to get a new domain, but it was also forced onto the Keeper, which could have dangerous consequences. Needless to say, any one of these risks would have entirely prevented Clover from ever attempting to ascend. Thankfully, the Keeper took the initiative to fully sever the ties between the two of them, allowing him to achieve today's result.
"Who should we apply with?" Lydia asked excitedly. "I think our old ship got destroyed in the first round of memetic shield testing, so we'll need to find a new one to join."
Clover nodded, already pulling a terminal out to make a call. From the other end of the connection, a young feminine voice spoke up.
"Oh, Clover, that you? Long time, bud. How you been?"
"I'm good, Vella," Clover chuckled, shaking his head. "You still working at the agency?"
"Yep. As a priestess of Auravi, it is my duty to bless those seeking to travel to unknown lands."
"Does that mean you're back in the game? I heard that you'd retired."
Clover hesitated for a moment before confirming it.
"I'm thinking I'm back. Lydia and I are looking for a ship that we can join together. You can update our applications, too. I've taken on the role of a god of exploration so I can help navigate dangerous terrain. Lydia is the goddess of explosions, so she'll be useful as a more active combatant."
"I see, I see. Are you both still wanting to take on a role as advisors as well?"
Vella asked, though Clover hesitated again. This time it was Lydia that spoke up on his behalf.
"Unfortunately, Vella, I don't think we really qualify for that position anymore.
The only type of advisor anyone would be wanting nowadays is one that has a high ranking in Codex Chaotic."
There was a long sigh from the other end of the call after Lydia said that.
"You're right. They've actually started to issue a form for that. If you want to be an advisor, you have to disclose your highest cleared level of CC. I thought that the two of you might have done some work on that while you were off the rosters, but I guess not."
Clover readily confirmed it. "I've spent all my time going around Deccan, Lorik and Fior, so I haven't had the time. And as for Lydia,
I've been making everything explode to train myself,"
Lydia said with a wide grin, causing Vela to chuckle. Well, got it. Let's see. A ship that's looking for both a navigator and a combat specialist willing to pay for at least two more deities added to their roster. There are three that you can choose from. You can join the Arbiter, the Falchion, or the Last Laugh. They're all exploration vessels and all planning to leave in between 3 and 6 days. Aside from the Last Laugh, all of them have at least one other deity on board, whether fallen or otherwise. The two of them looked at one another, silently communicating. Additional deities would mean a higher level of security, and there could even be those that they could ask advice from. "We'll go with the Arbiter," Clover answered, and they could hear the sound of Vela typing.
"Got it. The Arbiter is planning to disembark from Earth in 4 days. Make your way to Orbital Station 2 and give them your names. They should be expecting you by the time you arrive. Anything else while you have me?"
"That's fine. Thanks again, Vela," Clover replied with a smile, closing the connection. He took a deep breath, calming himself down. If they were really doing this now, that meant that they would likely be fighting against more mimetic monsters. He could still remember what happened with their last ship, the bridge full of corpses. Lydia reached over, gently grabbing his hand and giving it a small squeeze. She knew him well enough to know when he was worried about something.
"Let's take the next couple of days to brush up on Codex Chaotic," she suggested, earning a nod from Clover.
"Yeah, that's probably a good idea." There was no telling what sort of mimetic entities they'd be facing in the future, so learning some more tricks to deal with them would definitely not hurt. A deep, clanging echo could be heard from deep within Olympus, sounding akin to a giant's roar. This echo sounded every few seconds, sometimes sending vibrations throughout all of Olympus. In his forge, Tubrok grit his teeth, bringing his hammer down upon the anvil, shaping the reddened metal. His eyes were bloodshot, the muscles in his arms tensed with every strike, more so than his usual work. He had been among the first to know what happened to the March Golems. He was their creator, after all. First, the gear turned to tyranny, eventually being removed from the universe. Now the March had all but met a similar fate. Of the three types of golems he originally created, only the Mitong still stood at the height of their power. His forge shook every time Tubrok smashed his hammer down, divine sparks scattering in every direction. His mind was filled with all of the golems that he had created in the past, whether they were the Mitong, March, the Gear, or his personal projects. They all flashed through his mind. Perhaps he wasn't in his right mind, feeling the pain of a father that just watched their son pass away. He wasn't that connected to any one golem, but when there were so many of them. Soon the metal beneath his hammer blackened, turning gaseous with each strike. Small explosions echoed in the air, but he paid them no mind. His thoughts were focusing, every swing of his hammer shaping the material beneath him. The gas seemed to flicker in and out, and it was almost as if Tubrok was directly striking the anvil itself, which cried at the impact. Its screams became more blackened gas that wrapped around Tubrok's hammer, until finally, the hammer itself shattered. Tubrok's cheeks were cut by the shards of his oldest divine artifact crashing into his face, but he still refused to stop. He balled up a fist and began to slam it down onto the anvil, shaping the formless material with nothing but his raw strength and divine authority. After nearly 3 hours of non-stop hammering, he stretched his fist out, seeming to grab the intangible mass which was drawn to his hand. His hand glowed and emitted a hissing sound. When he unclenched his fist, there was a black burn mark on his palm.
"Are you there?" he asked in a gruff tone,
the air around him seeming to twist in response to his words.
"You won't be dying on me, will ya?"
Again the air distorted, and Tubrok nodded his head.
"In that case, go. Eat your fill, and remember, I'm watching. Don't you go misbehaving now."
The air behind Tubrock caved in on itself, a black portal opening up before immediately closing. An instant later, a silver-haired elf ran into the office with wide eyes.
Tubrock, what did I just sense in here?
New project. Nothing you need to concern yourself with for now, he said with a grunt.
Tubrock? Did you make a void, Golem? Leowyn asked.
Tubrock shrugging his shoulders and moving to pick up the fallen remains of his artifact hammer.
Gotta do something. The world's evolving, Leo. You gotta either get ahead of it, or it'll get ahead of us. Don't worry. This won't turn out like your little guardian project.
Are you sure about that? She asked.
And Tubrock gave a firm nod.
Aye, I am. I'll be keeping an eye on him personally. I set up enough defenses in that lad to make Chelsea blush. If he goes wrong, I've got 20 different ways to end his existence without a major show.
Tubrock had a surprisingly firm tone, and Leowyn's gaze softened as she walked over, placing a hand on his shoulder.
Let me see your hand, she said, in a gentle tone. I can still sense the trace. If you don't get that looked at, it will fester in your divinity.
Tubrock grunted, holding up his blackened hand, which Leowyn took and began to carefully extract the void energy from.
Just tell me that this wasn't spur of the moment, and that you've been thinking about this long enough to know what you are doing.
Tubrock let out a long sigh, his shoulders slumping.
Aye, lass. I've been thinking about a void golem since V-Day. Golems are similar to the void monsters in that they're creatures initially established on a hard set of rules. Just been holding off till now because I wanted to make damn sure that I knew how to control what I created and stop it from turning into one of them void gods.
Chapter 114. The following day, after being told where to find their ship, Clover and Lydia arrived at the orbital station. The two of them were more than strong enough to escape from Earth's orbit without any need for a vessel to carry them, especially now that they had both become gods. When they arrived, they were directed to a large ship with a sleek design. Clover immediately began to analyze the ship, comparing it to those that he had been in before. The main body off the ship was longer, but also not as tall. In many ways, it looked like an oversized missile. However, it was still large enough to require at least 100 people to properly crew the ship.
You must be the Chris.
A man approached them with a smile. Immediately, Clover and Lydia could sense a trace of the void on him, and realized that this man must be a fallen god. Outwardly, he appeared human, with black hair and dark eyes, having a lean build.
That's right. I'm Clover, and this is Lydia, Clover spoke up, introducing the two of them, each of them shaking the man's hand after he extended it.
Sebastian Powell, the other man said in greeting. I'm the fallen god of command, and I am the captain of the Arbiter. If you need anything, please feel free to ask.
A fallen god is the captain of a vessel? Lydia asked, surprised. Captains were usually mortals, or at the most, someone that had achieved perfection. It was very rare for a deity to take the role. This was not because they were unsuited to the task, but rather because gods were more of an emergency force or an advisor on most vessels. Sebastian gave a small chuckle.
That's right, ma'am, though I only became one during the recent downtime. From my understanding, the two of you are the same, exploration and explosion?
The two lichen deities nodded their heads, and Sebastian gestured for them to follow him.
Please, come inside. Let me show you around.
Within the void, a small crack could be felt, a tear opening in the emptiness as a black mass appeared. Once in the void, it formed a vortex, drawing the essence of the void into itself to give it a proper body. The body that it took was similar to that of a muscular humanoid with pure white skin and black empty eyes. With the void as a backdrop, this creature was particularly eye-catching. Once it was done forming its body, it stood motionless,
its eyes roaming over the monsters circling around the various barriers.
This golem was not like a normal void beast, which only had a limited number of rules. Instead, the golem was closer to a program, more akin to an artificial intelligence than an instinct-driven beast. However, it did not have that final spark that granted it a true soul. This was because the process of awakening an artificial intelligence involved awakening a divine spark within the intelligence and forming the soul around that. Tubrak had been worried that this step would inevitably clash with the Void Golem's core, so he took a different approach. What Tubrak did was create an artificial intelligence that was just on the edge of awakening, and then thrust it into the void. There, it could complete itself by absorbing the information of other beasts. For now, it was similar to a far more advanced version of Anna. Its head slowly lifted, eyes locking on what looked to be a field suspended in the void, more than a dozen beasts roaming the field and eating the feed provided to them. The golem felt a sense of danger from this area, as if it would never be able to leave if it entered that pasture. Instead, it turned to face a void beast swimming through the void, looking like a writhing mass of tentacles covered in a black mist. The golem's black eyes flashed green as it assessed the information within this beast.
Causes shed body parts to turn into amorphous masses that attack their former hosts.
It shook its head at that, deeming this to be a rather poor information sample to absorb. Next was a headless man, two faces growing out of his shoulders. One face looked as if it were laughing, the other crying. Once again it scanned the void beast to analyze its rules.
Causes sentient beings to understand the truth of a subject through verbal communication, removing any attempts to conceal the truth.
After analyzing this rule, the golem's eyes went from green to red. Its vision zoomed in on the creature that it had identified, and suddenly it was standing right before its target. The laughing face showed an expression of surprise when it caught sight of the golem, turning as if to run. However, the golem was simply faster, or rather it moved faster than opponent could hope to match on instinct. In the moment that it appeared before its target, it increased its personal flow of time by more than 1,000-fold. With this accelerated flow of time, the movements of its prey couldn't even be registered. Calmly, the golem stretched its arm out, grabbing one of the humanoid beast's arm and pulling hard. There was a sickening crunch as the arm was pulled from its body, the other following seconds later. With both arms removed from the humanoid beast, the golem used its fists to crush the two faces, causing the beast to fall still. The golem's eyes flashed green once again, determining that the beast was truly defeated, its rules starting to dissipate. For the first time, it opened its mouth wide, its jaw reaching down to the center of its chest. The inside of the golem's mouth looked to be a black abyss, drawing in the body of the beast that it had just slain. The beast disappeared into the gaping maw, first its severed arms, and then the mangled corpse that had been left behind. After the beast disappeared in its entirety, the golem went still once again, its eyes turning blue while it digested the information that it had devoured. Tara let out a small sigh within the admin room, laying on the bed with her legs draped off the side. Her eyes were closed, focusing her sights on the golem within the void. Her feline ears twitched as the door to the room opened, and Calliope walked in.
"Yo, sis, how's it going?"
Tara gave a small chuckle at Calliope's intrusion. She often came in to check on Tara, as Tara was the only one not fully capable of descending into her incarnation for prolonged periods.
"Hey, Kelly," she said as she sat up. "Just keeping an eye on Tubrak's newest creation."
"Oh, what did the mad lad make this time? Let me guess. It's some kind of sentient gemstone that could harness the power of emotions," Calliope asked, walking over to drop herself onto the bed next to Tara, who laughed lightly.
"No, though that would be interesting. No, he made a void golem and released it into the void to hunt void beasts. Calliope's eyes widened when she heard that. You serious? That crazy dwarf. We've got enough to worry about with void beasts already, don't we?
If things go well, this golem should be able to clear out some of the older ones, Terra said with a small smile, though Calliope looked confused.
It's not the older ones I'm worried about. It's these new ones with all those twisted rules.
You know, I heard that someone found a void beast that had a rule to turn people into whatever they ate. It was apparently trying to work its way into Spica when it was found.
Terra smiled slightly, shaking her head. Those are the old ones. Remember, Kelly, the void has been around forever. The longer a void beast exists, the more time it has to adapt and add to its rules. New beasts with particularly tricky rules can be dangerous, but the really bad ones are those that have had time to evolve.
Calliope hesitated before nodding her head in agreement.
Where do they come from, anyways? I mean, they don't exist inside of a system-generated world, so they shouldn't follow normal monster-spawning rules, and last I checked, Dale never set up rules for spawning in the void.
Monkeys and typewriters, Terra said, causing Calliope to look at her in confusion.
Terra let out a long sigh.
It's a saying from Dale's old world. Basically, if you put a monkey in a room with a typewriter, eventually it will create coherent sentences or even write out famous works of literature.
I'll take your entire stock of typewriting monkeys, Calliope deadpanned, causing Terra to giggle in amusement.
Not like that. It's not a fast process. This is an eventually theory. Basically, even if you hit random keys on a keyboard, you will eventually make words. Void beasts work in a similar way. Throughout the entire void, the information within it is constantly crashing against itself. Every now and then, this information smashes together just right to form a coherent rule. Once that rule is formed, the leftover information is used to construct the body.
I think I get it. Calliope nodded slowly, before blinking. Does that mean that it's possible for an entire world to be spontaneously born, in the same way as a void beast?
Terra blinked, but nodded in agreement. It's theoretically possible. However, the sheer amount of coincidences that would need to come together for that to happen, even if I used my fate domain to stir up the odds, it could take a billion years. More if you want the world to actually be stable.
Right. Sorry. Calliope nodded. So after they're born, these void beasts are just drawn to other sources of information. Like an animal?
That's right, Terra confirmed readily. They're made from this random information, but they aren't complete entities. They yearn to complete themselves by growing and gathering more information. In the end, they can become like that void god that they fought in the invasion.
It's a good thing that we've never had anyone get that far, Calliope muttered,
though Terra shook her head. Actually, we had one that was pretty close at one point. When she said that, Calliope turned to face her with wide eyes. It was a while back, a void beast that created contracts. This allowed it to fly under the radar for a while, until it decided to turn its focus to a game designer, planning to use his platform to infect the world. When I noticed this, I sent the twins to lead him to Leowyn, so she could deal with it. That was the most intelligent void beast we've ever had, and it could have very easily turned into a void god if it was allowed to complete its plot.
Calliope's brow twitched slightly.
I think I remember hearing about that case, though I don't remember it being described nearly as severe as that. Terra simply gave a small shrug, grinning.
Rules are rules. Dale didn't even know what void gods were back then, or had any concept like that. The most he knew, or had evidence of, was just really powerful void beasts. So given that that was technically not wrong, that is how the contract beast was described.
You cheeky cat, Calliope let out a light laugh, but reached over to hug Terra's waist. Although Terra played it off with a playful tone, Calliope knew that she didn't like to keep information like that from Dale, and only did because of the system forcing her to do so. Chapter 115.
I was out in the instance dungeon, training my various divine abilities once again, when suddenly I noticed a ping from the system. Half of a month had passed from when Bella Rose sent me the memetic sensor through that last invasion, so it was time to be notified of the next invasion a month and a half away. My opponent this time was someone known as Darkest Night, and I was once again being invaded. Although it was a rather ominous-sounding name, I didn't particularly pay it much mind. After all, Starkiller was one of my best friends among other keepers. Instead, I just opened the guild chat to send a message to the others. Earth Force One. Hey, everyone. Everlasting. Oh, hey. Who'd you get this time? Earth Force One. Huh? Everlasting. Those of us that were on defense last time just got our new matches, so we were going over who we had been assigned. I figured that's what you were here for, too. Earth Force One. Ah, right. The system told me that my next opponent is called Darkest Night, and I'm on the defense. After I sent that message, there was a lull in the chat. I couldn't tell if nobody had heard of that name or if everyone had. Eventually, Alice was the one to break the silence.
You don't have the best of luck when it comes to opponents, do you?
Earth Force One. Is it that bad? Everlasting.
You could say that. Darkest Night is in a rather special category of monster keepers, and has earned a bit of a reputation because of it. You know by now what it takes to reach the next level as a keeper, right?
Earth Force One. Being able to create a complete world without the system's help, right? Everlasting.
That's right. For monster keepers that don't nurture a civilization, this is actually a major bottleneck. Most monster keepers overcome this by spending a lot of points to create a monster race that has the ability to create such a world on their own. Otherwise, they'll be stuck at the top of the fourth rank.
Earth Force One.
I'm guessing Darkest Night didn't do that?
Everlasting.
Right. This makes him sort of like Ragnarokker, a predator in the fourth rank. Of course, his infamy also means that there is a lot of information known about the types of monsters that he regularly uses.
Earth Force One.
If he's as bad as you're hinting, I'd appreciate any information you can give me.
Everlasting.
Right. Well, the main thing is that he nurtures what people refer to as cosmic monsters. The smallest of his creations can be considered a living moon, while the largest could swallow up entire solar systems. Of course, because he's in the fourth rank, some of his creations have the power to exit a universe and devour it from the void as well.
Earth Force One.
Okay, normally I would say that's terrible, but will they be able to get through the hyperlane barrier and the wall of memetic monsters outside of it?
Everlasting.
Quite easily. The sheer size and speed of many of these monsters defies logic. It is very likely that the memetic monsters wouldn't even register to his creations before they are eaten in passing. As for the barrier, it only targets monsters that have void-like properties, so it will pose almost no resistance to these creatures.
Great. I'm going to need to play space defense again, I muttered to myself, hand on my forehead.
Earth Force One. If all of this information is known, there's got to be some reliable method to destroy his monsters, right?
Old Beard.
Ah, I know this one. If you have deities specializing in destructive domains, they are really useful. Otherwise, generally anything that can reduce a planet to ashes can deal with most of his creations. The bigger ones? Yeah, you're going to want gods for that.
Noted.
Part of me wondered how these monsters could even be created in the first place. But my assumption was that he used a really large world, maybe even size 10. If that was the case, it would make sense for the creatures born on it to be of such a cosmic scale.
Earth Force One.
Anything else I need to be aware of before I start planning my defenses?
Everlasting.
He's fairly consistent with his attacks, at least the ones that he loses and we get information from. Obviously, we don't know if his pattern changes for the matches that he wins, but usually he will send 2,000 smaller monsters able to devour a size 4 planet.
500 that are able to devour a size 5 planet, 100 that are able to devour a size 6 planet, 10 that are able to devour a size 7, and 1 able to devour a size 8, everlasting. Aside from numbers, the abilities of the monsters changes with each invasion, so that's all the help that we can give. Earth Force 1. So I should be expecting 2,611 monsters, 11 of which require gods to fight, and the rest just need incredibly powerful ships. Oldbeard. Don't let the lower numbers fool you. Remember that the invasion can occur anywhere in your domain. Some might even appear directly in the void. You'll have to have the forces to defend against something of that scale spread out all across your various universes, and still have the strength to fight them. Otherwise, you can expect that you'll lose several planets before you can pinpoint their location. Alice was right. I only saw the low numbers, and thought that I might be getting off relatively easy. What would the people of my various worlds think if every world had an artillery satellite capable of reducing the planet that they lived on to ash? It was certain that there would be backlash from something like that, and rightly so. A malicious hacker would be able to take the entire planet hostage, or just outright destroy it before the Greater Pantheon was able to stop them. Granted, destructive gods were all able to release similar levels of power, but there was a difference between a living being wielding that level of power and an inanimate object that anyone could potentially take control of. I let out a long sigh, shaking my head and focusing. Dana, Tsubaki, Lifra, all of you meet me in the admin room. Everyone else, get ready for a big meeting. We've got news of our next opponent, and we're defending again. This was my third defense in a row, and I was honestly wishing that I had the chance to attack, for once, especially if it was the chance to attack someone that I could really go all out on. If there was anything that I could consider solace, it was the fact that this was likely to be my last invasion in the fourth tier. At the rate that Chelsea was developing her world creation technology, it was entirely possible that she would finish before the next invasion. She might even finish it before this invasion if I speed up time to help us prepare our defenses, which is something that I typically do when we are fighting a defensive battle. Closing my eyes, I returned to the admin room, pleased to find that everyone was already waiting in the meeting room, serious looks on their faces. "So, what are we fighting this time?" Calliope asked, crossing her arms and leaning against the table. "You wouldn't call us all here if it was just another pass like before, or is it a big trade partner?" "No, it's a fight," I confirmed, and the atmosphere turned a bit heavier. Our opponent is called Darkest Knight. Thankfully, he is quite infamous, so I was able to get a good deal of information on his patterns from my guild. "Well, if you've got all that, you should already know how we need to fight him, right?" Dana asked, a small grin tugging at her face as she tried to lighten the mood. "I know the method, but we're not prepared," I said, and she let out a long sigh. Darkest Knight fights with cosmic-level monsters. These are creatures capable of devouring entire planets, sometimes even whole solar systems in their passing. Some of them can exit into the void and eat an entire universe. According to the others, the best way to deal with his monsters is through a combination of destructive deities and interstellar weapons systems that can reduce entire planets to ash. We have plenty of the first, but not enough to safely cover all of our occupied planets. As for the latter, I looked over at Ashley, who shook her head. "If you were just talking about cracking a planet or making it uninhabitable, most of our exploration ships possess something capable of that. However, if it requires the power to reduce a planet to ash, that is something else entirely. At the moment, the only weapon that we have that is capable of that is Olympus's main gun." "Olympus has a main gun?" I asked, blinking. Tubrok let out a snort, nodding his head.
"Aye, course it does. Olympus is constantly building up excess power within its systems until it reaches a critical point,
Once this point is reached, the main gun can fire, and anything as big as Lorik can be destroyed with one big hit. However, this gun has a lot of charge-up time since it only uses excess energy and the ambient power of its inhabitants. It takes about 3 days to reach full charge.
Noted. Regardless, we can't mass-produce Olympus, and at the same time, we can't place these weapons too close to our occupied worlds. It would be entirely unsafe and unwise to do so, because the inhabitants would be constantly living in fear of the death laser that could be aimed down at their planet.
Well, where do you want to put it, then? Acalia asked with a curious tone, leaning back in her seat with her hands behind her head. If the monsters spawn inside of one of our solar systems, we can't keep them too far away, or it will be too late by the time they're calibrated to fire inwards.
Right. That's why we can't put them on satellites in the first place. I shook my head, letting out a long sigh. Satellites would either be too close for public safety or too far to be any good in an emergency. We have to put them on ships, which means we need to incorporate it with all of the existing systems that could get in the way, including the power requirements. Aurevi couldn't help but roll her eyes, grinning slightly.
It sounds like it would have been better to have these as specialized ships. Destroyer class would be a bit risky as a title, given that they won't be leaving the Hyperlane network. Defender class would be a bit more apt. Ships capable of massive damage, but unfit to leave the zones protected by the Hyperlane barrier.
Does that mean that we'll be giving up on all of the planets outside of the barrier? Behenna asked, her brow furrowed in frustration.
There's not much helping it, unfortunately.
Irena shook her head in response. Even if we had all the time we needed, establishing defensive points throughout every universe to offer full coverage simply isn't feasible. We can only focus on defending the territories that we have occupied, and given that the last invasion already removed all life on the unexplored worlds, all that we are giving up on is empty planets. My concern is something else. Everyone turned their heads to look at Irena when she said that, and she began to explain.
What if one of these monsters appeared in Fior? Clearly it would not be able to eat all of Fior, but we would be hard-pressed to fight it.
If this monster destroyed the Mana Spire, it could take an entirely unreasonable amount of time to reach it and fight back. And given how much airspace there is in the upper levels of Fior, I believe that cosmic monsters could very easily appear there.
She's right. Udonna nodded her head, a grim look on her face.
We'll need combat gods on every level of Fior that's large enough for these monsters to appear, and then more around every planet we have occupied, together with the new Defender-class ships that Aurevi mentioned.
Chapter 116. How long do we need to get everything ready? I asked, looking around the room. I've been holding back on fast-forwarding for a while just so that I could let the world develop naturally. However, if there is an imminent threat and we need more time to take care of it, I'll naturally give you all the time needed. Tubrock and Ashley looked at one another before Ashley spoke up.
In terms of weapons research, it could take anywhere up to 20 years to create weapons capable of planetary annihilation that we can build on a large scale, right?
Tubrock nodded his head in agreement.
Aye. We don't want to just pour in a load of energy like with Olympus. That'll be too inefficient, and takes too much time to charge.
Dana hesitated for a moment before speaking up.
If we're doing another time skip, I think I'll remain on world for a while. I want to finish my Sky Chariot project. From what's been discussed, I think it could be useful in the upcoming fight, even if it's just symbolic.
I gave a small nod at that, remembering the project in question. It was meant to be a warship that would allow me to channel any of my domains through it. However, Dana had never completed the design, or had perhaps abandoned it after V-Day.
10 to 20 years, huh? Chelsea asked, crossing her arms in front of her chest.
She glanced over at James, who was sitting next to her.
Think we can get it done by then?
James thought about it for a long moment. If it's just copying an existing world, probably. We'll need to see how the stability holds up, though. But designing a new one would probably take a bit longer than that. We'll need to run experiments and figure out how to implement the changes in different cores to get the results that we want.
I glanced over at the duo as they discussed that. Will we hit the next rank from copying an existing world, or does it have to be something new?
Can't say.
Chelsea shrugged her shoulders. We never hit that level in our past life, so we're in uncharted territory. Likewise, Terra won't be able to tell us exactly, because you haven't hit that goal yet. Your friends from the Guild might be able to answer, but I wouldn't say that it's important. We'll find out one way or the other when it happens.
Right. I nodded my head in agreement.
Is there anything else to discuss while we're at it?
I'll need a little time to prepare before you hit the button, Ashley spoke up, causing me to look over at her. There is a limit to how fast my team can act while in the admin room. Given that the collaborator for my NPC project is still immortal, it would seem like we cut off contact for 20 years if we did so right away. Instead, I'd like to set up a long-term assignment for him with a 20-year deadline. That way it can be turned in when the time jump is completed.
Makes sense. Also, are there any new systems that we should be preparing to install after this period? I asked, to which Ashley had a thoughtful expression.
My team has been busy lately with the NPC project, so they haven't had much time to work on personal projects lately. I'll let you know once we have something worth considering for the world again, she answered, with a shake of her head.
All right. Anyone else? I asked again, looking around. This time it didn't seem as if anyone else had any other comments to make. In that case, Ashley, let me know when you're ready. Everyone else, take care of whatever preparations you need, and I'll start the acceleration.
The others in the room all nodded their heads, standing and heading for the door. In the end, only Tsubaki and I were left behind, and I sat down in my seat with a long sigh.
I do not believe that you should let this worry you so much, my keeper, Tsubaki said with a confident smile, standing behind me. With the knowledge that you have on your enemy, I believe that it will only be a matter of time, of which you have all that you need.
I gave a small nod at that.
I know. My concern is whether or not Darkest Night will just do his usual casual attack, or if he is going to decide to send more after us.
What do you mean?
Tsubaki asked with a tilt of her head.
We have 2 wins under our belts, one of those being from a rather fierce keeper that earned his own kills. That means that we are actually quite a bit wealthier than a keeper at our level would be that hadn't experienced a victory in battle. For an enemy keeper like Darkest Night, this could make us a prime target, especially given how new we are. Just the right mix between the lack of experience and an enticing reward.
I see. So, you are worried that he will attack in greater numbers than what you received in your report? She asked,
to which I nodded my head. That's right. Not just the number of monsters, even the scale of them could be beyond what we heard in the report. According to Sarah, the largest monster should be capable of devouring an entire solar system at once. I have to consider the possibility that Darkest Night reserves his largest monsters for battles he intends to take seriously. In the worst-case scenario, there could be a creature capable of swallowing an entire galaxy.
Tsubaki's eyes widened slightly when she heard that, before holding her chin in her hand.
I see. However, I believe that would be somewhat impractical. Even given the idea that this keeper specializes in larger and larger monsters, it would become inefficient to nurture those monsters beyond a certain size. Instead, I believe he would simply change the target of devouring while reducing the size of the monster in question. For instance, the swallowing carp. When I arched my brow at that term, Tsubaki explained,
"This is a rare monster found in Deccan's ocean, prominently spawning after V-Day. The swallowing carp is a fish of no more than 1 meter in length, and a third as thick.
However, this is one of the most fearsome creatures that can be found at sea, due to its unique ability. When the swallowing carp opens its mouth, it releases an intense suction force known for creating whirlpools in an instant. Anything that is drawn towards its mouth shrinks rapidly, becoming no bigger than a grain of sand. Once inside its mouth, you will find yourself in what appears to be an independent world, full of everything that the fish has swallowed in recent times, while a potent acid begins to dissolve everything. Of those that encounter this creature, very few are known to survive. The report on its interior actually comes from an old god of water that was caught up in its attack while exploring the ocean. He managed to escape before he sustained too much damage and wrote online about what he experienced. If this other keeper follows a similar trend, then their most terrifying monsters won't be those incredibly massive ones, but rather smaller monsters that are able to freely enter and exit the void, rapidly consuming entire universes. While this would not be as visually impressive as, say, a gigantic dragon with a wingspan larger than a galaxy, it would be the more efficient route to take when developing a monster. I hesitated at Tsubaki's explanation. While insightful, it didn't really help me calm down. I suppose that we'll be needing to increase our void defenses as well. Tsubaki nodded her head, before blinking as a thought occurred to her. The truly terrifying concept would be if one of these swallowing beasts was able to store a universe that it had consumed within its stomach, and possessed the intelligence to wait for a good moment to attack. If that was the case, they could simply hide in a forest or uninhabited planet while we fought the rest of the monsters. Then, after days or weeks of battle, when we were frantically searching for the remnants of the attack, it appears in the void and releases the universe it previously stored. This universe containing the true attack force. I believe this is what I would do if I were using a similar build and determined to ensure a victory. There was a long pause after Tsubaki said that, and I turned my head to look at her. I thought you wanted me not to worry. Galahan sat in his office, looking over the message that had only just arrived with a curious expression. Dear Galahan, be advised that we are entering into a long-term project. This project is expected to take roughly 20 years to accomplish. During this time, there is an assignment for you to perform, due upon the end of this 20-year period. You are to create a narrative for a living universe, which is built within a universe that functions with the following systems. These should all be taken into account as intrinsic facts about the world. There is a crafting system in which players are able to automate the crafting process after registering a recipe. This happens through the creation of a special crafting facility, which brings up an interface for what to craft. The time needed for each craft, as well as its quality, depend on both the recipe and the level of the facility. Every individual, upon reaching a certain age, gains powers at a divine level. For some, these powers will be in the form of a domain, while others will simply gain an enhancement to their natural abilities that will allow them to fight on the same level as gods. There is a fast travel system through which people can visit any city that they have previously visited. This happens by attuning oneself to a special structure located within the city. There is an inventory which increases in size in accordance with personal power. This inventory functions similarly to the real-world system with one caveat. Mana can be spent to increase the inventory size, as well as ki and divine energy. Although there is a level system, there are no classes. The terms mage and fighter merely indicate one's talents, rather than a class that is enforced by the system. Levels represent an individual's total fighting power, with the divine baseline as level 100. This is also the level that everyone rises to upon the previously mentioned age. The magic system in this world is arcano-binary, the same magic system commonly found in fragments of Ascidia. For this reason, the world should have a general science fiction theme, as opposed to more magic in nature. The final system of note is the respawn system, which even NPCs will have access to. All entities, whether players or NPC, will respawn 24 hours after their death at their last register travel point. However, if they die a second time within 7 days of their original death, they will not respawn. This is the case for players as well, who will have their characters deleted if they repeatedly die in this manner. We look forward to seeing the world that you create within these guidelines. Aside from what has been stipulated above, you have the creative freedom to customize the world as you see fit, with one restriction. There is to be no mention of specific gods or locations from the real world. Lastly, if you create a world with which you are satisfied before the deadline, you are free to use it as the setting of a movie or broadcasted series if you desire. If you do so, and the setting is approved at the end of the deadline, these materials may be considered as promotional material for the completed product. His eyes widened slightly as he read that last section. It was surprising that he was being given such a long-term project, though he knew to some extent that this would eventually happen due to his original conversation with Ashley. Additionally, he knew that the ban on using real-world people and places was because this game, once completed, could be sent to other keepers. What surprised him the most was the freedom to create